Welcome, my friends, to the Generations Radio broadcast. My name is Kevin Swanson. I'm a homeschool father of five, and we are raising our children during the demise of Western civilization, the breakdown of faith, family, and freedom. Yeah, 18% of millennials now attending church on a regular basis, down from 55% for the silent generation. That, my friends, is a major apostasy, and it's a concern of mine that we salvage something of the faith in the 21st century for our children and grandchildren. I'm hoping and praying that others are as concerned, and there are others who want to see something of the faith salvaged. Now, we have undergone the social revolution, yes. We underwent political revolutions over the last 150 years, but what about the cultural revolutions? If you lose the political battles, it may be because you've lost the cultural battles. If you lose the cultural battles, forget about the next generation. Forget about salvaging the faith. Forget about salvaging freedom. Forget about any kind of political freedom in the years to come. If you do not address the cultural battles and the cultural revolutions that are before us. That's why we ask the controversial questions about music. Are we better off because of Elvis Presley and the Beatles, and yes, Larry Norman, and what they left us over the last 40 years? Are we better off because of the musical cultural revolutions of the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s? Is the church better off for what Elvis Presley and the Beatles and others gave them in the 1960s and 1970s? Are we better off because of Elvis Presley and the music he was listening to in the 19 or playing in the 1960s and the music he produced for hundreds of millions of people around the world to listen to and to adapt into their forms in their churches in the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s? Are we better off? That's the question I'm asking today, because revolution does produce the unraveling of culture. Now, friends, over the last 40 years, we've seen these revolutions, and we want to address these highly critical questions to the survival of faith, family, church, culture in the years to come. I'm going to interview Paul Durcher in just a minute on his move towards establishing family bands across the country. And also, Dr. T. David Gordon is the author of a new book, Why Johnny Can't Sing Hymns. It's been around a few years, and we're going to replay an interview with him in just a few minutes. But first, we're going to talk to the editor of a new music magazine who's going to speak with us on family music. I have young people come to me from time to time and ask the question, should I listen to rock and roll? Should I listen to CCM, contemporary Christian music? And oh, by the way, the father of contemporary Christian music was Larry Norman. And he passed away just a few years ago. Before he passed away, I read on his blog that church music has not done the church any good. He said we should throw the music out of the church for the next 10, 15 years and just teach the Word of God. Okay, now that's the father of contemporary Christian music before he passed away. Was he right or was he wrong? Important question, a critical questions for the survival of the faith and culture and the family in the years to come. Well, when people ask me the question, should I listen to CCM? Should I listen to rap, hip-hop? Does this express the fear of God adequately? Is this healthy for my spiritual growth? Or is it detrimental for my spiritual growth? Or is there some form that would be healthier for me than this? When they ask me these questions, when kids come up to me and ask me, should I listen to contemporary Christian music? Should I listen to rap? Should I listen to the holy hip-hop? My answer is very simple. And by the way, I've written a new book on this. Are you ready for the title? The Tattooed Jesus. And my answer is very simple. What do your parents think? If there is a disrespect for a parent's wisdom in relation to cultural choices, there's going to be a breakdown of culture. It's going to happen. Now, I don't think you can get past this. If there is a disrespect for a parent's wisdom in relation to cultural choices for the teen, there will be a subsequent breakdown of culture from generation to generation. There must be an honor of parents if things will go well with you in the land, period. Now, this is a very simple biblical argument, and I make it strongly in my new book coming out called The Tattooed Jesus. But how do we repair the breach of culture, the fatherlessness and dishonor for parents has brought to a nation in a wholesale manner? Here are two things. Number one, unplug. Listen to music as a family. Been doing this for the last 6 months as our family. Develop your taste as a family. Hold each other accountable to music forms by listening together. Okay? So unplug. That's number one. If you want to salvage the next generation, if you want to salvage culture, unplug, and then secondly, family bans. I'm going to talk to Paul in just a moment on this issue of family bans. Stay tuned. This is Generations. Hey dads, is it time to get away with your sons to build those relationships? Remember, fruitful relationships is what it takes to have a fruitful life. How you disciple your son has everything to do with the relationship you have with your son. So don't miss a once-in-a-lifetime experience at our father-son retreat at the Crooked Creek Ranch in the Colorado Rockies this August. This year, we will be featuring speakers like Scott Brown, Dan Einerson, Mike Chappa, Steve Vaughn, and yours truly from the Generations Radio program. You'll enjoy outdoor activities, training sessions, including wilderness first aid, mountain survival, blood tracking, as well as sports activities, swimming, high ropes course, rock climbing walls, kayaking, and hiking in the beautiful Colorado Rockies. And we're cutting the price for the 2014 Father-Son Retreat. It all happens August 28th to the 31st at the most fabulous retreat center in the Colorado Rockies. Register today for our Father-Son Retreat at check.org. That's C-H-E-C.org. That's check.org under Check Events on the web. Or call toll-free 877-842-2432. That's 877-842-2432. And welcome back to the Generations Radio broadcast, friends. Today, we're going to talk about family bans. And we've been on this topic several times in the past, but there is a new magazine out called the Family Band Magazine, familybandmagazine.com. And Paul DeRocher joins me now on the Generations broadcast. They've got their own family band as well. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Kevin. It's great to be here.
Talk about your family band. How many children do you have, Paul?
Well, Kevin, we have 12 biological living children, and three of them are married and moved on with their lives and grandkids, and we have 9 still living at home. Wow. So we're traveling these days.
How long have you been traveling as a family band, Paul?
We have been on the road for 6 years, pretty much full time, doing a good number of dates all over the country.
So you've traveled coast to coast. And you're playing, I assume, churches, fairgrounds, festivals, that kind of thing?
Yeah, we do all of the above, Kevin. The majority of what we do is in local churches. I mean, we believe in the local church. I was a pastor by trade for years, and so that's kind of where our heartbeat and our passion is. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we play mostly in churches, but we also play a lot in prisons and rescue missions and homeless shelters, and we do a lot of K-12 schools, celebrate recovery groups. Like I said, prisons is one of our favorite events to do. So there's a lot of places, like we work with churches and do concerts in the park and outreaches and just entertainment type events. There's quite a variety of stuff we do, but you bet.
So you've been at this for a long time. You got a new magazine coming out called the Family Band Magazine. Give us the upside. What's the blessing?
Yeah.
What has happened in the 8 years you've been traveling with your family?
Okay, just real quick, though, a quick correction. We are Christian Family Band Magazine. Christian Family Band Magazine is the name of our magazine. The website is familybandmagazine.com. We shorten that up just to keep it simple and easy.
Okay.
But, yeah, as we've been traveling, you know, it's kind of neat to be out in all these churches and just really catching the heartbeat. Mm. And our ministry is really so varied and multifaceted. I mean, there's what we do on stage, which is really just a small part of what we do. I mean, we roll into a church with our bus and our trailer and our dog and our family. You know, our little one was 3 years old when we started doing this. And, you know, we're hanging out with people. We're hanging out with music people and pastors and host families. And so a lot of what we do takes place around, you know, on the periphery, not necessarily, you know, what stage.
Relationships matter in discipleship and in, you know, evangelism. You got to build those relationships. You can't get people saved by standing up on a stage and just singing. That's usually not the way people get saved. It usually happens through relationships and through ongoing discipleship.
That's right. And that's another one of the fringe benefits of kind of what we do as a family, which puts us in a little different category than other entertainment venues or other maybe music ministries that are on a national level, and I think this is true of all family bands, is that we build those relationships with local churches. Mm. We build those relationships with host homes, with their kids. You know, when we go to the potluck after the event or the ice cream social or whatever, we don't all just sit at one table. We spread out. We divide and conquer. We mm-hmm. connect with people. I mean, my kids have been in touch with people on Facebook and on email for years. And when these kids turn 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, and they want to, you know, fly out of orbit, you know, they've got, you know, my daughter emailing them saying, hey, what's going on in your walk with the Lord? You know, hey, I see some of these posts coming out on Facebook are looking a little scary.
Yeah.
You know, where's the Lord in your life right now? And so mm-hmm. there's that ongoing relationship-ness of what we do.
Yeah. So the benefit to the family, it keeps the family together. So you have more opportunity to do the walk along, talk along. What has that meant for you, Paul, and your family?
Well, for us, you know, we have a ton of family bonding time. We're together, you know, a lot as a family. I mean, think about it. We live in a 40-foot long bus, you know, for 6 to 10 months out of the year. So
yeah.
that, you know, really allowed us to get to know each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had a family business before that. So a lot of families capitalize on family businesses and, you know, it increases the discipleship process. It increases the sanctification process,
yeah.
you know,
uh-huh.
you know, people often laughingly say, you know, yeah, we tried the motorhome thing. We did a week vacation. We were ready to kill each other, you know. So, I mean, there's that aspect of it that, you know, you're in the crucible of who you are as a Christian 24/7. You know, the most important place to live the Christian life is in your home and with your family. The people you need to show the most love to, the most forgiveness, the most kindness is in your family. You know, we can all put on a false face and go out into public and go to the youth event, go to the youth group, go to church and put on that false face. But really Christ calls us to be Christians 24/7 and to live that out. The number one place, which is behind closed doors. That's the hardest place to be a Christian.
Mm.
And we're seeing that worked out today in the falling apart of the family and the divorce rates and the abused kids and the dysfunctionalness of our American family culture.
Sure.
So, you know,
so hopefully this is a way to restore it. We talk about reintegrating the family in lots of ways, in businesses, family businesses. You know about our family economics conferences and family-based education, you know, at the homeschool conferences. And so this is another way to integrate. And, you know, I think integrating music tastes helps too. How does that work for you? How do you integrate your music taste? Is it just the fact that you learn to enjoy together, you're unplugging? People aren't plugged into their earphones all day long, so you're enjoying it together. You're experiencing it together. Is that part of it?
Yeah, that's definitely a part of it. I mean, obviously, as parents, you know, we're from a different generation than our kids, and we come with our own musical interests and likes and whatnot. And so, you know, and then our kids, as they branch out, and you know, we're all kind of connected and watching YouTube and connecting with other family bands from around the country and. You know, appreciating different musical styles. So there is that blending. There is that, you know, working together of the generations. There is that spanning of the generations, you know. It's not all about my music and what I like. It's about our music and what we like and God and what, you know, his ideal is for music. And, you know, when we find stuff that's, you know, maybe culturally edgy and we have chance to talk about that and to evaluate it and say, well, we like about it? What do we not like about it?
Right.
Cultural discussions, you know, as families. And of course, you know, that's what's going on in churches all over. It's the contemporary versus traditional and churches are having that conversation all over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How many family bands are there? When I saw you starting a Christian family band magazine, I thought, is that like for four families
you know,
in America? I'm thinking, how many family bands can there be?
Yeah, it is a pretty small slice of the pie, you know, in whole of our country. There are a good number of them. I think we identified about 150 of them just in the circles that we know and those are in all different, you know, some are just little startups that are just at the process of playing in their local, you know, little local circle market to others who are, you know, travel nationally even much more extensively than we do.
Mm-hmm.
And I would probably for everyone that we know about, there's probably 5 or 10 that we don't know about. So,
sure. mm-hmm.
a fairly small pie out there. And also the ones that are doing it, you know, trying to do it professionally, trying to do it as a ministry, you know, those are the ones that we're trying to find as well and, mm-hmm. and tap into their circle and fan the flames of what they're doing and provide some examples, some instructions, some unifying cohesiveness to some of those other families that, hey, I got a kid in piano, I got a kid in violin. We think this is really cool. What can we do to, you know, start playing some music together? Mm-hmm. And how can we capitalize and maximize some of the benefits and the joys of doing ministry together as a family? Whether it's missions or whether it's helping out at church work days, whatever, our magazine is really not all about music. Our magazine is about family discipleship.
Yeah.
We're using ministry and music ministry and families ministering together as a spotlight, as a means of creating family discipleship. So just as a point of clarification, as we talk about Christian Family Band Magazine, it does sound narrow and there aren't a ton of families out there doing this. Yet at the same time, family discipleship touches every one of us. And
you
at
bet.
The core of that, families serving together in ministry.
And you can't get apart from talking culture and music as you develop a family discipleship program. You've got to be talking culture. We did around the dinner table this morning. You know, we were talking about How to Train Your Dragon Part 2 and some of the edgy elements of that, you know, new cultural production. You've got to be bringing this stuff out and developing something of a family culture. Here's a question for you. Is there a market for family bands? And where are you guys finding the market? I guess just about anywhere is what you're saying.
Yeah, you know, and that's a great point. And that's one of the reasons why we are creating Christian Family Band Magazine, because although there is a market, quote unquote, for it out there, there's no unifying factor. There's no professional market. There's no national market. I mean, there's a handful of churches out there that have opened their doors to us over the years, and we've had some great events and we've had some terrible events, you know, but what we're finding is most of the churches tuned into contemporary entertainment culture. So if you're not one of these big name bands, or you're not all tatted up, or you're not super culturally relevant, or you don't have management, you're not getting national radio airplay, people are looking at us and saying, oh yeah, cute, a little family band. That's really cute. And what they're not understanding, what they're not seeing, is the humongous potential for ministry to really touch lives for our young people who are, you know, godly examples, not perfect kids, but godly examples who are gifted and talented musicians and vocalists that you know, are approaching a level of great professionalism that you'd see at a Branson show, that you'd see on, you know, a CMT music video kind of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, here's an opportunity for your kids, for your local church, for your family, to connect with some other people that are making a difference for the Lord.
I applaud you, Paul, for what you're doing. I appreciate the fact that you are lighting a candle. And, you know, we're always looking for solutions. We're facing this massive musical cultural revolution that is tearing apart generation from generation, and you're developing, you know, your Gen X, Gen Y, Gen Z, Gen LMNOP churches, where the silent generation can't get along with the millennial generation, the millennial generation's not getting along with the mosaics, and it's just, the whole thing's coming apart as I see it. We've just got to find ways to bring solutions into play, and I find that your concept of encouraging family bands is wonderful. And no, it's not just a magazine for 150 families. It's a magazine for tens of thousands of families, many of whom listen to this radio program, whose children play an instrument, whose children play at the local rest home for the locked away elderly that need a little community and a little encouragement and fellowship on the part of families who care for them. So what I see here, Paul, is tens of thousands of families that need to plug in with what you're talking about. This is a wonderful, wonderful product, and I want to encourage folks to it. It's familybandmagazine.com, Family Band Magazine, or for the DeRocher Family Music, just go to DeRocherFamilyMusic.com, DeRocher FamilyMusic.com. Paul, I hate to tell you this, but the time has come to wrap it up.
Sure.
Some last words here to encourage those family bands who may be, you know, thinking about it, maybe a little bit on their last leg. They're not sure how to continue and whether it's worthwhile. Give them a little encouragement.
Well, one of the most encouraging things that we see is families building together. I mean, this is a unique venture in where we can appeal to multiple generations. One of the few things that really appeals to multiple generations are music events as we reach out and touch people. We got little guys that are in there, and little kids see that. They're inspired to go home and practice. We got teenagers. I got six young adults ages, you know, 16 to 24 that are godly, amazing instrumentalists and musicians. And, you know, the sports world says, hey, we don't want to be your role models. You know, don't look to us as your role models. You know what? We all need to be accountable to one another. We're not star musicians. We come in and set up and hang out with people. So we appeal to those young people, old people like us, parents connect with us. They say, man, we only got three kids. You know, how do you guys do it? You know, so we're like able to say, look, if we can do it, anybody can do it. And family bands provide that. They have a level of professionalism. They have a real ministry. And they're providing some awesome music, some creative originals, and some really cool stuff. A lot of them are filmmakers, too. We're getting into filmmaking. That's a whole nother deal. But you talk about the culture. We're making YouTube videos. Check out our YouTube videos on our website, on our Facebook page. And it's a great opportunity to not only be together as a family, but that's not the end. That's not the goal in itself. The goal is to make a difference for the gospel, to reach out with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And not just proclaim Christ's death, burial, and resurrection, but to proclaim obedience to all the things that God has commanded us. That's really what the Great Commission is, to live out the Great Commission in a life of generosity, in a life of kindness, in a life of love, in a life of joy, in a life of serving others. So I think family bands are uniquely poised to kind of cheer on this process. And like you said, light that candle and build these generations and bring these generations together. Pretty much everything that the contemporary church is doing divides the family. Mm-hmm. This is a opportunity to unite the family around the cause of the gospel, and we're super excited about it. We need your listeners to get on board, to subscribe. Our magazine will be out August 1st. Our first issue will be out, and there'll be a subscribe button on our page, and so we need a ton of people to get on board with that.
All right. Well, that's wonderful. Love the concept and appreciate what you've been doing, and I appreciate the fact you're a cheerleader for others as well. Paul, thank you. God bless you, and I'm encouraging people to your website, familybandmagazine.com or DeRocheFamilyMusic.com. Paul, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kevin. You have a great day.
And we'll be back in just a moment. Hang in there.
And we are back on the Generations Radio broadcast. Kevin Swanson, your host, with you today. And the last 20, 30, 40 years has been a massive revolution, a wild revolution in music, especially in the church, friends. This revolution has infected the church in a tremendous way, far more than any other change we've seen in the last 500 years. And we're asking the question today, is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? We are seeing certainly generational discontinuity in the culture, in the music of the church, and it's coming faster and faster and faster. And to talk about this with me is Dr. T. David Gordon. He's written a new book called Why Johnny Can't Sing Hymns, How Pop Culture Rewrote the Hymnal. And I'd like to welcome Dr. Gordon to the radio program. Welcome, Dr. Gordon.
Thanks, Kevin. Good to be here.
Dr. Gordon, you have watched the Christian faith, you've watched the Christian church move in a direction towards postmodernism, towards revolution in the culture and the music. How do you describe that? How would you describe it to, they say, a Martin Luther or a J.S. Bach, if you ran into them and had to explain what happened in the church between 1970 and 2010?
Well, you know, that would be the ideal person to explain it to in some ways, because I'm looking at the matter as a media ecologist, and what I would suggest is that our culture developed media that they had never heard of, and when I describe those those media or technologies to them, they might think I was talking about magic or pulling their leg for that matter. But that would make the point. Before you had electronic technologies, phonograph and radio, but especially radio, and the reason I say especially radio is because very few families had phonographs in the early years.
Hmm.
It was a fairly expensive thing. The radio was actually less expensive. And so all the way through the 1930s, probably, a home would be more likely to have a radio than a phonograph. This causes two profound changes in people's sentiments about music, their sensibilities. First, before the radio or the phonograph, all music was live. All the music that you're exposed to, everything that affected your sensibilities regarding music was live. That either meant that you heard a performance live, or what was equally common, if not more common, you sang it yourself.
Yes.
So folk music was the primary music that most people were exposed to in the West prior to, let's say, 1920 or 1930.
You didn't have pop stars singing this pop music in the 1910s or the 1880s.
No, because there was no broadcast. There's no way to broadcast.
Yes.
And so what happens is by the time you get to the 1930s, a critical mass of people in the United States have radios. And so broadcasting now can be the vehicle by which, for instance, FDR champions his presidency and explains to people his policies. He was the first president actually to use it in that fashion. It was the first of the mass media. But because it was a mass medium capable of reaching so much of the population, it was quickly put to commercial usages. And so the first thing that happens is music goes from being something that you participate in to something that someone else performs. That's one enormous change. The second change is, for commercial reasons, pop music becomes essentially the exclusive thing that is broadcast.
Yes.
They couldn't really broadcast much sacred music because ours is a land of freedom and not everyone had the same religion. And so that wasn't going to work. It might, in fact, alienate purchases of your product. And they couldn't do much classical music, though they began with that. The radio did begin with many classical broadcasts. But the problem with classical is it requires something of a learning curve. It's a little demanding to learn to listen to classical music.
Yes.
And if someone turned into it to hear the radio, and it was some tenor at New York singing opera, if he didn't have a taste for opera, he would turn the station to something else. And to what does he turn? Well, if you or I were producing commercial programming, we would want art that doesn't require a great learning curve to enjoy, and we would want art that can be quickly and cheaply produced.
Yes.
Which means that we'd exclude the Brahms Requiem, for instance, because it took Brahms 7 years to write that piece. He began shortly after Robert Schumann took his life and finished it shortly after his mother died. And so over 7 years passed for Brahms to perfect his Ein Deutsches Requiem.
Which we should say took longer than Elvis Presley to write You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog.
Took nearly longer than Elvis Presley to do his entire career.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And so what happens is really carefully artistically crafted music like that takes too long to produce, to fill the airways with it, and also it requires a bit of a learning curve. I love Brahms, for instance, but it took me several years of sort of concentrated attention to become a Brahms lover.
Hmm.
And so what happened is pop music, which had actually been only a small part of the typical repertoire of most people to that time, to roughly 1920 to 1930, pop music within 30 or 40 years became the exclusive form of music to which most people are exposed.
Hmm.
They hear it in the grocery store. They hear it in the Gap when they're shopping for jeans. They hear it when they're pumping gasoline into their car. They hear it when they're waiting to have their teeth filled. Almost everywhere we go, we have pop music in the background. And it is so pervasive then in our culture that for many people, it's the only thing that sounds like music. When some people say, for instance, then that they prefer contemporary music, sometimes, depending upon the relationship already established, I will say, now, do you mean you prefer it the way you prefer, let's say, chocolate ice cream to vanilla ice cream, and you've had probably an equal amount of both? Or do you mean you prefer it the way you prefer vanilla ice cream to pistachio, and you've never had pistachio before? because that's a critical difference, it seems to me.
Right.
Most people who say they prefer contemporary music prefer it the way they prefer the English language. It's the only thing they've ever known.
Yes, and we have seen radical changes in that form of music from Bing Crosby to Nat King Cole to Elvis Presley to Eminem and Katy Perry. The form of music, the style of music has changed dramatically and seems to change about every 2 to 5 years now. There's also this dramatic revolutionary effect that this music bears upon a society. It doesn't, isn't it?
Yeah, one of the things that I mention in the book is that the commercial forces for whom this is so important create a consumer's culture by selling two things. They sell their product, but before they sell their product, they sell a value. And that value then becomes the Archimedean lever by which they sell their product. And the value is new.
Yes.
The first commercial message I recall seeing as a young man was for Tide detergent back in the late 1950s, early 60s, and it was called New and Improved.
Yes, right.
And I noticed about a year ago a commercial for Tide, and it was called New and Improved.
Yeah, they've done it again, yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, by now it ought to get up in the morning and make coffee for me if it's continually improved that much for that many years.
Yeah.
So what happens is contemporaneity itself, the idea that newer is better and the old is passé, is a very important value for Madison Avenue. It's extremely critical to it because that's what causes them to get you to sell a perfectly good automobile that you've had for 3 or 4 years, traded in on a newer model.
So let's get back to Johnny, who can't sing hymns. If he's been taught revolution, cast off the old, cast off the old, cast off the old, bring on the new, bring on the new. If he's been taught that for the last 25, 30, 35 years of his life, then what happens to his church music?
Well, what inevitably happens is he's so used to being passive regarding music, right?
Yes.
That is to say, he's not an active performer of it. Music is normally something that he observes, witnesses, listens to, maybe taps his foot along to, and this kind of a thing, claps a little. Music comes to him as a consumer thing, as a matter that he purchases according to his preference. Now, this is very different when music serves sacred functions, which is, by the way, if you ask a sociologist, the primary purpose it is served culturally. Most cultures, most of the music in most cultures serves a sacred purpose.
Mm.
And before you had electronic technologies and commercial interest therein, music almost always served a sacred purpose. Now, in such a setting, if the music was there as a means of meeting the divinity, you learned to conform to it. But if you're in a culture where music is primarily a commodity that is sold to you, your whole approach to it is, well, I like this more than that. I like watermelon more than cantaloupe, so I purchased a watermelon. I like this kind of music more than that kind of music, so I want that kind of music. So part of what we have to do is to kind of cut through all of that, right, and get back to the fact that in the particular setting of the sacredness of worship, we're not talking about a commodity. We're not talking about something that is a commercial choice driven by personal preference. We're talking about something that is driven by the commandment of God, who calls his people to sing his praise.
Yes.
And if we looked at the other things he commands us to do in worship, to give attention to the word read and preached, to pray, or the sacraments, we would never even raise the question of personal preference. No one would say, for instance, well, our pastor's okay, pretty good preacher, but I prefer someone with a Scottish accent to someone with a Kentucky accent.
Yeah.
We would never think that such a silly thing should motivate us when it comes to preaching. We would want the person to be a good, sound expositor and organized, and if he did that, we wouldn't care about our preference for vocal styles. And we wouldn't with the sacraments. We wouldn't say, well, you know, I just preferred if they were to give a rose to the child instead of put water on his head at baptism. No one would ever think that because they prefer roses to water, that the sacrament should be driven by that.
Dr. Gordon, is there anything wrong with bringing contemporary music into the worship service if that's the form that the elders choose to use in the service?
Well, it's not unlawful if the elders choose to do it.
Yes.
And so it may be unwise, is the way I put it. It's certainly not unlawful
right.
To have living contemporary artists. as the church.
What would be your concern, though, if they went to a strictly contemporary service that was patterned after the pop music you find in the culture around us right now?
Well, the two concerns would be the cutting oneself off from the rest of the church.
Yeah.
And the second concern would be it just puts off the learning curve. If the problem is that we can no longer connect with the rest of the church in her hymnody, the only way we will learn to do it is at some point to do what I did with Brahms, make a little effort and learn how to do it.
Yes, yes.
And so there's a sense in which it's sort of like saying, suppose we told a preacher to preach six-minute sermons so that the children could follow it. Well, okay, the great thing is the children could follow it. But how would they ever learn to listen to a 30-minute sermon? They would never learn to do it. So part of worship is learning to worship.
I think part of the teaching of the church is to mature the body of Christ in their knowledge and their cultural emanations. They've got to do both. They've got to somehow go down to wherever the culture is and raise the culture up and mature the culture. And that doesn't happen when you're constantly working at the lowest common denominator, whether in music, in content, in preaching, or whatever you're doing.
That's correct. See, in our culture, I refer to ours as a pedocentric culture, a child-centered culture.
Yes.
And that's just the opposite of a biblical culture where the goal of childhood in the Bible is to leave it behind you as soon as you possibly can. The Bible constantly praises those who are older and wiser. Paul says, when I was a child, I spoke and reasoned and thought as a child, but when I became a man, I gave up childish ways. And he says to the Corinthians, to be babes in evil, but in your thinking, be mature. He's constantly urging people to be mature.
Yes.
Then our culture constantly urges them to be immature and thoughtless and impulsive and childish, and again, largely for commercial reasons. How do you get people to do impulse buying? You cultivate them as impulsive people.
Yes.
And so the commercial forces want us to be like children who just say, mine, mine, daddy, daddy, get one of those. They want us all to be that way. They don't want us to mature.
Yes.
And so that's what's behind it. But now, let me go back to the first part of my answer. Why would that concern me if we cut ourselves off?
Yes.
If we think of the analogy of the body of Christ, Kevin Swanson has gifts that David Gordon doesn't have. And on his good days, maybe David Gordon has one that Kevin Swanson doesn't.
Yes.
And Paul teaches us that we are all healthier when we are able to benefit from the gifts that God has given others. Well, now, if the church is 2,000 years old, and if we define a generation, as the Bible does, roughly by 40 years, then we are roughly at the point now where there have been 50 generations of Christendom.
Yes.
Now, let's assume that no particular generation of all of those, even my favorite, the 17th century German hymn writers, even that one, let's suppose that no generation has yet figured out hymnody perfectly. Well, then the best thing to do is expose ourselves to all the gifts of all the generations of the churches, so that if there's a blind spot in our generation, it's compensated for by another generation, which might have its own blind spot.
So a decent hymnal, in your estimation, would be a hymnal that would include something from Ambrose, something from the 5th century, the 8th century, the 10th century, the 12th century, the 14th, 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries.
Yes. And in fact, I might even say that I wouldn't even attempt to do it every single week. I pastored for 9 years and didn't attempt to do this every week. But it wouldn't bother me if every week we had a psalm somewhere in the service to connect ourselves to the praise of those Old Testament saints. And it could be sung or unison or whatever, I wouldn't care. It would be great if we had a hymn from the ancient church, of the Father's Love Begotten, or O Gladsome Light, something like that.
Yes.
A medieval hymn, perhaps Bernard of Clairvaux's O Sacred Head Now Wounded.
Yes.
A hymn from the Reformation Church, and a hymn from the post-Reformation church.
Yes, yes.
But what happened then is the peculiar strengths of the body of Christ and its peculiar weaknesses all blend together to edify us in a better way than if we do otherwise. So just think of this. If we're now in the 50th generation of the church and we only listen to one generation's music, we are throwing out the gifts of 49 out of 50 Christians.
Well, and you speak.
Now, if you did that on a local level in a typical church of, let's say, 150 people, what that means is you would only be ministered to by three people in that church. You throw out all the others.
Yes. And in the end, you talk about the modern culture, modern musical forms as impoverished and weakened. And is there any wonder why the church is breaking down in the 21st century? We are perhaps the weakest as far as a church is concerned as we've been in the last 500 years since the Reformation, at least in my estimation.
Yeah, and if you look at the kind of material that is being sung, it is not ordinarily heretical, which is damning with faint praise. That's a little bit like going to a restaurant and saying, "I didn't get transferable disease from the chef."
Yes.
If all you can say is he didn't kill me,
right.
That's damning with faint praise.
Right.
I would think.
Right.
It's not just merely that it's not heretical. The point is, it rarely affirms anything that could be judged to be heretical.
Yes.
And so. It tends to be as vapid and inconsequential as our culture is. And you mentioned Ken Myers before we came on the air. Ken Myers has essentially said that what distinguishes pop culture is its very banality, its insignificance, its triviality, its
yes.
inconsequentiality. It's not that it's ugly. It's just that it's fairly inconsequential.
Hmm.
And not surprisingly, then, if we want our church music to be analogous to it, our church music after a while becomes fairly inconsequential also.
And history itself is insignificant and unimportant to the average person. You make the point, I think a very strong point in the book, that that today people are looking at the news and listening to the news, and their lives are framed by this, and Lindsay Lohan's jail time is more important than Patrick Henry's Stamp Act resolutions 200 years ago, because whatever's happening, whatever's changing in the present day is the most important, most significant thing, and who cares what happened in history? It just doesn't have an impact on people anymore. They don't care.
Yeah, that's right. We've been trained to be contemporaneous by the commercial forces because, again, that's their way of selling us what is new. If they can create in us either a benign neglect of the past or even an overt contempt for it, either one works for them.
Yes.
It can even be a benign neglect where we say such things as, well, that was nice for them back in those days when they rode horses to work. Even if it's a benign neglect, it has the same effect.
Mm-hmm.
If they can teach us that we can live a perfectly good and wise and fulfilling life by being cut off from all of previous civilizations, then they can sell us the new routinely.
Yes. Doctor,
so I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want people to shave as I do with a 1904 Gillette double-edged razor.
Yes.
Because they don't make any money off the replacement blades off of it.
Right.
They're so inexpensive.
Right. Right.
And so I save about $70 to $80 a year by using a razor that my father and or grandfather could have used. It works absolutely as well as any contemporary razor, but they don't make any money off of it.
Mm. Dr. David Gordon, and the book is Why Johnny Can't Sing Hymns, How Pop Culture Rewrote the Hymnal. Dr. Gordon, before we're done, we have to, I think, give people a sense for where we're going here. And we do need to hang on to the old. It's absolutely essential to maintain, I believe, this generational continuity from previous generations in our family life, as well as in the larger Christian historical pattern from years past. But how do we hang on to the old? How do we retain the heritage that we've received in past generations while at the same time not stagnating in our culture and singing a new song to the Lord? So I see there's a both and here. How do we connect the generations?
Well, one of the things that I would suggest is my understanding of those psalms about singing new songs are references to new acts of redemptive history in which we ought to write new psalms about them. So I'm not so sure that there's any biblical mandate that says that we have to write a new song for its own sake.
Yes.
However, I do think gifted Christian artists in every generation ought to express themselves artistically, informed by the Christian vision, which means in every generation we would expect some hymn writers to show up. So that's fine. My point would be this. In no previous generation of the church did we feel such an impulse to, quote, connect to the youth.
Yes.
In every previous generation, young people were expected to grow out of it. And they were proud when they did. I can still remember tying my first tie. It was a vertical tie at the time. I now tie bow ties. But I can still remember how proud I was to tie my own tie when I went to church on Sunday morning rather than to have a clip on. And I think I still remember my first suit rather than just a little sports coat and something like that. My first actual suit because that's what my father wore as a businessman, a real suit. And so through all of human history until about 30 years ago, what we did is we cordially opened our arms to the youth and said, here's what adult people do, and we welcome you to join us as soon as you prove yourself responsible to.
Yes.
And now many people think that we have to take a different tack and say to young people, we want to be like you. But to me, that's like Jesus saying to the rich young man, let me give you some money. The last thing a young person needs is any more encouragement to be adolescent. Mm-hmm. They need to be encouraged to be adult.
Yes.
And to be responsible. So the last thing we do in ministering to them is to tell them it's fine for them to remain as youthful people, cut off from everything but their own adolescent ghetto. They live in Lord of the Flies.
Mm-hmm.
Their electronic technologies, their Twitters, their Facebook, their texting and so forth, put them in their own adolescent ghetto, more so than any previous generation. They are cut off from the world of adults.
Well, we appreciate the interview with you, Dr. David Gordon. Why Johnny Can't Sing Hymns, How Pop Culture Rewrote the Hymnal. Incredibly important concepts, ideas on this edition of Generations. I believe if we salvage the culture, if we're going to salvage civilization, if we're going to salvage the church and church music in the years to come, we have to reconsider the way we've been teaching our youth in the area of music. And your contribution to this discussion has been invaluable. Thank you very much, Dr. Gordon. We appreciate you.
Thanks very much for having me. I've enjoyed it.
A lot of information shared on this edition of Generations, folks. We want to connect ourselves with church history. We want to take hymnody vitally seriously because this is the way that we praise God and the way we continue to build the church of Jesus Christ from generation to generation. And we've got to link the generations in the way we do our culture. I want my great-grandchildren worshiping in my church with me, if God gives me that much time here. I would love to see great-grandparents and great-grandchildren worshiping in the same church together with the same worship service, the same culture, the same music. Is this possible? I suggest to you that it is. Stay tuned in, folks, to this Generations Radio broadcast as we continue to bring this vision to you each and every day. You can interact with the show by emailing me directly at host@kevinswanson.com. You can also hear the program anytime, anywhere in the world at kevinswanson.com. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.